the lovely Rhian, and she's going to be running this evening's discussion. And there'll be some panel discussion, and then we'll involve you lot, the great unwashed, in further conversation.
You can include me in that as well.
So if you'd like to give a good green belt welcome to the panel.
When I was waiting to start this, Ben was saying that in here last night, the session on non-violence became violent. So when he says he's used to handling difficult situations, I do feel we're in safe hands. That's quite funny, that. So if anyone feels, you know, up for fisticuffs, that's great, because it'll make for a far more lively discussion. I'm Rhian Roberts. I work for the BBC. I am a radio journalist, a programme editor, and now I do management type things. We are expecting Sarah Miles to join us, and I hope she will walk through the door shortly. But whatever happens, we will have an interesting and enlightening conversation, including you and the two panellists here. I'm going to ask them to introduce themselves and say where they work and what they do, and then I'm going to ask you a couple of questions, and then we'll see where we go. Thank you.
Hello. My name is George Pitcher. I used to run an advertising agency called Luther Pendragon, and now I work for The Telegraph, because I thought I'd go over to the other side.
My name is Colin Morton, and I'm a wanker.
Right.
Now, come on.
That's a good start. No, I'm Colin Morton. Sorry. The real answer is that I have the laughable title of executive editor of The Independent on Sunday, which is, there are only four of us anyway, so I wouldn't take that too seriously. And I also do a bit of broadcasting, and I also write books, and that's it, I think.
That's enough.
Yeah.
George.
Political bias clearly on the part of the sound engineer. I'm George Pitcher, I'm religion editor of Telegraph Media, which is the multimedia Telegraph 24/7 platform, which to your me means the Daily Telegraph and the Sunday Telegraph and the online content. I took a commercial break to run a PR company, actually not advertising, called Luther Pendragon for about 15 Sorry. Years, which I sold in 2005, but I was a journalist before that with The Observer. They are.
Okay, I just want to see, are there any journalists in the room with us?
Hey.
Can you just call out quickly yes, who you work for so that we can just be careful to insult you properly?
just
the Portsmouth and
Anglican Diocese.
The Anglican Diocese of Portsmouth. Yeah. Wonderful.
Regional
ITV. BBC, BBC South West. Any others?
Former journalist from the Church Press.
Former journalist from the Church Press. Go to the back. The Little Hampton Gazette.
Top stuff.
Anybody else? Take it back. The Mothers Union Magazine editor is sitting at the back. Wonderful. Malcolm Doley, I know you're a journalist as well. Sorry, just pull you out. Do you want to say who you work for?
Cole, I work for Cole.
You work for Cole. One day we all work for Cole.
I haven't paid you for several years then.
Anybody else want to be outed? Okay, I just want to ask a question. Who here thinks they keep up with the news? Okay, shall we just do a news bulletin? who reads a newspaper, say, more than once a week? Oh. Good, good. Keep your hands up if you read a broadsheet. Posh paper. Put your hands down. Put your hands up if you also look at a tabloid. Excellent. Anybody buy, you know, crap like I do? Heat, Reveal, Closer, interested in Celebrity?
Church Times.
So, am I right in concluding from that that people in this room are largely not interested in Celebrity? I don't believe you for a moment, and I think we'll probably get to the reason why I think that.
Yeah, won't we, Jeff?
Anybody listen to the radio or not to get the news? Well done, you can all stay, our biscuits are on me afterwards. Television news? BBC? Prefer ITV? And do you love Channel 4?
Yes!
Okay.
About five.
Just wanted to see whether we were talking to a group of people who were here to listen to us or just to shelter from the rain. That's excellent. I want to start by asking our panellists, sorry, it's a bit weird that I'm standing here going backwards, never mind, I'll figure it out. I want to ask the panellists what they read and listen to and why. George.
I listen to the Today programme in the morning, I suppose, because it wakes me up. I'm interested actually in that. I've been interested in what you have to say because the editor of the Telegraph, Will Lewis, doesn't listen to the Today programme. He listens to Radio 5 Live.
Yeah.
And I'm not quite sure what the reason for that is, but he's one of the great disaffected from the Today programme. I'm a recent returnee to newspapers, so I'm sort of in a transition period because I used to, you know, when I returned at the beginning of May, I started reading all the papers like I used to when I was in full-time journalism 15, 17 years ago. And then I had to catch up with this whole online business. So I look at a lot more online now, and I'm kind of getting the children to teach me how to do that, and mark favourites and so on. So I guess I probably read as much newspaper content online as I do in my hand now. I read The Spectator on a weekly basis to know what the enemy is doing. I can't think of anything else really. I read a good deal of The Guardian. I think The Saturday Guardian is very good. And of course I stay in touch with the Indie for obvious reasons.
That's a very interesting phrase, isn't it? Stay in touch with.
You can't read.
Not read. Okay. I read the Telegraph all the time. In theory, read them all every day. I know that sounds gargantuan, and it kind of is, but I do flick through everything every day, including the tabs and the FT and all of that. And it's soul-destroying, frankly. And listen to the Today programme because I have to, because everybody else does. Not really all that pleased with it. Listen to Jeremy Vine at lunchtime. He's got good lately.
Jeremy Kyle.
Danny Baker on Radio London. I listen to a lot of radio all the time. 4 and 5 and 2 and 1 sometimes and London and all that. And in terms of online news sources, I use the BBC News front page a lot. Got it on my mobile phone. Got BBC and Sky alerts on the phone, so if anything happens, they come to me. And yeah, that's it for now.
So if you were both not together, but on a desert island, and you can choose one newspaper to be delivered every day, or you can choose one radio programme every day.
Instead of the newspaper. No.
Or one television source of news. And when you leave your desert island after your year, you want to be aware of what state the world is in as regards news, not opinion. Which would you choose? And why?
Can we just go over the parameters again? So I'm slightly confused.
You're on the desert island.
Yes.
You can opt for a television source of news, a radio source of news, or a newspaper delivered daily. And at the end of the year, you have to know what state the world is in.
Not the internet?
No, kind of internet.
Oh, I see, you can't have that.
Okay.
No, because otherwise you just access everything, wouldn't you?
Okay, well, I'd go for Radio 4 then.
The Today programme.
Oh, only one programme
on
it?
I want to see what you think is
like
true.
It.
What I'm getting at is what do you most believe is telling you the truth?
All right, ask George and I'll think about it.
Okay, George, ask you and
I can't take sort of CNN or FT.com or something, no. I'll take CNN. I mean, I don't particularly like it, but it'd be running round the clock and you just keep seeing stuff, you know, whereas CNN would be updated all the time.
But, this is who we're killing today.
Or, you know, for real sophistication, I'd take Fox News.
But what you would get a strange view of the world at the end of a year.
But I think it's important to take media that annoy you rather than confirm your prejudices. I mean, I think it's important to have something that's stimulating, which is I have this argument at the newspaper quite regularly on the basis of somebody at an editorial conference will say, but I don't think our readers would like that, you know, and I kind of think that that's incidentally a euphemism for I don't agree with you, but put that aside a moment. What they're doing very often at editorial conferences is trying to match the newspaper with the readership, and I think it's a medium's job, a newspaper's job, to be provocative and get in the nose and up the nose and in the face of the readership to some extent. So I'm not sure that's why I went for CNN initially, because I think I'd want something that provoked in me an opposite opinion and a different interpretation. And I'm not sure I get that anymore from UK newspapers, so I'd probably want something that was keeping me alive by making me sufficiently angry and cross that I'd want to survive to get off the desert island to find out what was really going on.
Paul, that's good. I was disappointed by that answer.
No, I was impressed by it. He's obviously a fully rounded character. I think that's right.
What are you going to
I'm going to surprise myself with this answer and say that I would actually settle for the Times. It's a strange thing to say. Partly the same reason, and partly that I do think that at their best, one of the things newspapers can do, because we're sort of not able to keep up with the 24-hour thing, really, even though we pretend. So we do kind of reflect. And I think that broadsheet... or the heavies, or whatever you want to call them in this country, are pretty good at breadth, and they're perhaps a little bit better at breadth than a rolling news station is, or a radio station is. And I think that of all of them at the moment, reading them all every day, the one that always has all the stories that I think are important is the Times.
Okay. So now we know a little bit about what you both want from your news.
Well, not exactly, no, because in reality what I would actually do is I would read The Guardian, because I want to feel comfortable.
So why are you telling us one thing, but you're actually going to do another?
Because you had a different criteria. You wanted me to stay informed at the end of the year. Okay. It's not just about that. It's about entertainment, and it's about validation, and it's about feeling that you're part of a community and all of that. That's a different process. That would be, if I was buying one newspaper, I'd buy The Guardian, for all sorts of other reasons that are different to the parameters you gave.
Yeah, if I knew I was going to die on a desert island, I would take The Guardian. If I knew I wanted to get off and there was still work to do, then I'd take something that was challenging my preconceptions.
Exactly.
So do most of you agree with this, that where you go for news, you're not actually going there for news, you're going there to see your opinions of the world and the way you live your life reflected back to you in a way that is basically not challenging? If you agree with that, can you put your hands up?
It's not. It's the wrong question, Rick.
Oh, go on. Tell me what the right question is.
It's not that it's not challenging. It's that it's affirming or validating, or that you feel part of a community.
It doesn't make you cross, though, does it?
Well, that's for George to answer. But what I'm getting at is being part of a community, and some of the views in that community will make you cross. But, you know, I mean, we do it. The Guardian does it. Papers like that will put in commentators who are counterintuitive. But on the whole, it would be wanting to feel part of a group of people who are thinking through the same things.
I think I'd want to avoid getting tribal. That's the one thing that worries me about reading newspapers that affirm, to use your word, Cole, and maybe feel comfortable. One of the refreshing things about the editor that the Telegraph has at the moment, Will Lewis, is that he says... I'm thinking what you say reminds me of the other day when I forget what the story was, but we were looking for comment, and he was saying to somebody across the editorial table, I want the left-wing view, and I don't want somebody just to write what the left-wing view is. I want a left-winger to write the view, you know. And I think you want that element of surprise and challenge all the time, in, even when you're coming to a newspaper, because presumably Telegraph readers are, as Telegraph readers always have been, which are Telegraph, God, I don't I know it when it comes to online abuse, you know. But, you know, I think you there is something predictable about the way in which a newspaper that panders to your own preconceptions behaves. And that may be the Guardian for both of us, Cole. And as I say, I would want in retirement to know that I had the comfort of commentators that agreed with me. But in the meantime, I want Simon Heffer.
But pandering to preconceptions is what newspapers do. That's how they work.
That's how they sell, yeah. But I mean, the question was, which one would you take on a desert island?
Yeah, but I mean, that's how they're structured.
It's a different question for civilians to troopers like us, I think.
The thing that I find quite interesting, which apparently I'm getting wrong, is that you would take a different paper to make you feel happy inside, and you wouldn't trust that paper to also provide you with really good news service. That's what I've got from your answer.
In terms of the excellence of the news provision, it's tiny shades of degree between the Times and the Guardian. I don't think really that matters. I think that it's not about not wanting to be challenged. I'm going to repeat myself. Really, it's hardly worth it. But it's not about the breadth of news, essentially, and it's not about reasserting something that makes me feel comfortable. But it is true, and I don't think civilians, as you put it, sometimes appreciate just to what extent it is true, even in choosing columnists that are counterintuitive, that newspaper editors and planners and advertisers and everybody else are trying to work out exactly how to pander to your preconceptions. That's what they're doing to get your pound or your £1.50. It's a pretty simple commercial transaction, really.
I'm just going to welcome Sarah Miles, who I think has joined us.
Sorry that I got stuck in the brain.
Pleased to see you. I just want to put a quote to Cole and George while we get Sarah sorted out. Nick Davis, who was supposed to be here and can't unfortunately be with us, has an interesting quote in his book. Stories cluster around the same narrow set of political and moral assumptions about how the world should be run. Okay, so who sets the same narrow set of political and moral assumptions, and how do you change them? What is the process of changing them?
Oh, well, me.
Who sets the assumptions by which the Telegraph decisions are made? I'll put it that way.
Well, you know, to return to a point that Cole was making, to some degree the readers do, because I was thinking about what Cole was saying as he was saying it.
That's a good start.
And clearly you're not going to start producing a newspaper that allies itself to the International Socialist Workers' Party just because that would be invigorating to the Telegraph's readership. So clearly, first and foremost, the readership prescribes that. But I think at the heart of what you're saying, Rhiann, is something more interesting than simply market research. And that is that there's a limited number of world views into which dialectic is channeled. And I suppose there is that still out there the kind of authoritarian capitalist, if you like, strict law and order right wing thing, and there is the more liberal world view. And I guess that if you wanted to start putting media into their tranches, you could pretty much pick up where they're going to go searching for their readers in those broad tranches. And I'm not sure that necessarily that that's a bad thing. I think probably what we've done is moved on from a world in which media reflected the moral assumptions of their owners, which they did as recently as 30 to 50 years ago. You know, the the consumers of media have much more clout and influence over what media produce today than in, quotes, the old days, when the Rothermere's or Hartwell's or press proprietors were producing, or even the Reiths, for goodness sake, were producing media that reflected their own worldview. The attention now is much more on a commercial bottom line for those proprietors, so they're in a sense pandering or exploring what they're going to sell more of to you and to me.
Okay. Do you want to sort of take that on behalf of the Independent?
Yeah, I can do. A couple of things to say before that. One is, in terms of the subject, the title of this discussion, which was, do we have the press we deserve? On one very simple level, of course we do, because if you just stopped buying the Daily Mail and the Sun and stopped watching Big Brother, the world would be a better place, right? Yeah, easy points to score at Greenbelt. I appreciate that.
Thanks for not putting the Telegraph.
Well, I think people assume that.
Bigger rush.
So we get that stuff because people buy it. And you might say, well, they're manipulated into buying it, and you might well be right. But we also believe in freedom of choice, don't we? And we also believe that, you know, we have individual responsibilities to our society and in the consumer choices that we make, and we can't deny that. And I came into this with all the idealism, you know, as somebody who wanted to be a writer, not particularly a journalist, as a younger person, with all the idealism about, you know, being campaigning and uncovering truth and all of that stuff. And to a certain extent, I still do hold it dear. And to a certain extent, I'm kind of, you know, let's say one day in 100, I'm proud particularly of something that happens. But I've also become acutely aware over the years of the commercial realities of that. And I want to give you one very specific example relating to my paper, which is, I probably shouldn't tell you, but I'm going to anyway because I trust you. And it relates to the war on Iraq. In Iraq. And you know, at that time, particularly the Independent on Sunday was the most vocal in opposing the idea of war and the build-up to war and the actual war. And I was, for what it's worth, I was proud of that because I felt like I was in the right place at the right time writing stuff that mattered, that had something to say that was important. And the actual reality of why we did that is very commercial. We essentially made the decision to become an anti-war newspaper because the Observer had decided to go pro-war, and it opened up a commercial space for us. And the way that manifested itself is that people in the boardroom suddenly said, oh, who in this room, not, you know, who in the building is anti-war? Take two steps forward. Let's see if we can build up a head of steam with editorial process. They gave us room to exercise that creativity and put that point of view, but they did it so they could drive a hole in the Observer's sales and create a bigger commercial opportunity. So that's why that happened. Now, you have to decide, and I have to decide on a daily basis, whether or not it's worth it. But, I mean, that happens all the time in every subject. For example, we tried to position ourselves as a green paper. What would happen if you took all the car ads out? Be a disaster. So, you know, yes, I think we can get into dialectic, but we also have to talk about advertising.
Can I just ask a supplementary question?
Press pause, because I want to introduce Sarah, because I feel me, because it's been raining and she got here late, so I'm going to press pause. Is that right? Sarah, can I introduce you, because I want to welcome you, because you are from Foreign Climes.
From Foreign Climes, exactly, where it never rains.
Do you want me to introduce you quickly, and then you can correct me?
Certainly.
Because I'm a journalist, bound to get my facts
certainly,
wrong.
Certainly, absolutely.
Sarah Miles, former editor of Mother Jones, an influential and radical blog based in the US, yeah?
Magazine, yes.
Yeah, sorry. Magazine, online magazine. Journalist covering the war in Central America.
Yes.
Chef.
Yes.
A priest in San Francisco?
No.
No. Oh, well, good. That's wrong. Well, how can I describe your...
I'm a non-ordained minister.
A non-ordained minister in San Francisco. Thank you very much for joining us. And we'd like you to just chip in.
Good.
We've been quite noisy and voluble so far, and hopefully you will increase the noise and the volume.
Good, that's what
but
I like.
I'm taking my finger off Paul's
Can
there.
I just say, can you, no, you sound really interesting. Can I come and stay with you?
Anytime, we'd
Thank
love
you.
To have you.
Just like
it never ends there.
So I'm going to take my finger off pause and apologise to George.
That's
Is
right.
that all right? That Sorry right. if there was a break in the narrative there, but I'm trying to be polite as well as...
So good.
Yeah.
Could I just ask Cole if the Observer had gone anti-war, whether you'd have gone pro-war?
I expect so. I expect it would have been difficult because we'd already slightly gone in that direction. And it was more a question of them saying, if you're slightly going in that direction, for heaven's sake, go the whole way. I think we would have
rode in
back.
Here.
Yes.
Because I actually think one of the things that disturbs me the most about the press isn't actually about anyone's opinions, because there are lots of opinions. What disturbs me is the shrinking space for reporting, for actually looking and reporting and trying to find out a story rather than simply repeating a line or repeating two or three lines. And certainly in the United States, the space for actual reporting and the funding has just disappeared in the last 20 years. Where you used to have bureaus, you now have one wire service at most, or people just sort of picking up a line and repeating it. And I think it's less about the point of view that is allowed to be expressed than the idea that a journalist can actually find out what's happening, which is disappearing, or which costs, no matter what the point of view is.
So there's too much news, or too many news outlets, but not enough proper news?
Not enough reporting.
Okay, is that a problem where you work? Not enough proper
well,
reporting?
Well, less so to a degree, because that's still the stuff that we pride ourselves on, but in reality, yes, it is a problem. Because even in those places that pride themselves on good writing and investigation and diversity, it's still true that we are effectively following a lead because we're understaffed.
Yeah, I think a lot of this is a symptom of so much of it going online, and I do think at some stage there's going to be we're going to come up against a ditch, if you like, a trench, on the basis of having noticed where quality reporting has gone in the rush for online hits. And there is going to be, at some stage, a new commercial opportunity that's going to arise, because there have always been, and always has been, a demand for the kind of quality reporting that I think that Sarah's referring to. And I don't think it's going to be driven by high-mindedness, rather in the same way as Cole says that it's a commercial opportunity. I do think that it's withering on the vine, because everybody is blinded by the kind of 24/7 online opportunities and so on. We're all chasing that with such excitement that at some stage somebody's going to go, hang on, there's a whole community, there's a whole market out there that wants to, that will respond to heavily supported, by which I mean body count, a lot of people doing a lot of reporting of a highly qualitative nature, and will, you know, come up the other side of the valley into a broad sunlit upland of quality journalism again, but we're not there at the moment.
So do you think that if we had news outlets that were full of the truth as discovered by properly paid
journalists?
What would that be?
That's tricky.
We need more journalists to tell us what it is.
No, we don't. We need less journalists to tell us what the truth is. The truth isn't out there, I'm afraid.
Well, it depends. If you need more rigorous reporting and investigation, you would say you needed more journalists to do it. Can I just finish my point, yeah?
Right.
And you also had stories that were not fed by a PR machine, were not surveys put out there to get interest in a product, but were, you know, stories about places in the world that we don't tell the stories about now because we haven't got the money to invest in the journalists to go and tell those stories. Would we buy those newspapers and listen to those news outlets? Or have we, as a media-consuming public, become too spoilt? Our heads have been turned, we can't concentrate properly, we don't want that stuff. What do you think?
I think that when The Independent tries to do Africa specials, for example, when we go into bed with the Africa Commission and we do big detailed reports for the first 15 pages on really important aspects of African life and international politics relating to that, people turn to page 16, frankly. I wish they didn't, and I don't know why they do, but they do, and the research shows it. They still buy the paper. I mean, this is one of the contradictions of newspapers. is that, you know, people will buy an environmental front page or an African front page or a global crisis front page or a polar bear's drowning front page, but they will read the television review because it makes them feel better to have it, but they don't want to read it. That's what the research says, anyway.
Well, just on what you have to say about, you know, fearless searching for the truth. I mean, what you seem to be suggesting, Rhiannon, is that there's some sort of absolute truth out there that...
I just think that there is time to be spent on looking at stories more rigorously. And I know in the newsrooms that I've worked on, I can't devote the people to properly investigate the stories and report them. I can't. I haven't got enough staff.
Yeah, yeah. No, I see. But that's a different point.
So I don't even know if I'm telling the truth, because I haven't had the time to...
But even... Sorry, Sarah. I mean, you know, even when that happens, look at the Olympics. 437 BBC journalists, God knows how many others from other broadcasting corporations, and they have missed the stories, right? Because people have decided Olympics is a good thing, British success is a great thing, we're not going to rock the boat, we're not going to talk about human rights, we're not going to talk about protests, we're not going to talk about oppression. And even when the BBC or anybody else has chosen to do big backgrounders on China and the big issues, not many people have been watching or listening to those. But the fact is, loads of money have been thrown at that event, but because of the international agreement, this has to be a good, happy thing, those stories are not being told.
Well, let me name what the beast is there. The beast is this. It's not about dumbing down, but the lack of quality to which I think you were referring, Rhiannon, is attached to the fact that... Well, let me name it, and I think we discovered what journalists are here, so I think I'm fairly safe in this comment. But there has been a creeping Daily Mailerisation of news throughout the media, and that part of the characteristic of that is that something is not, or something is defined as a story if it's in another medium. In other words, a story gets chased because somebody else has it. And that makes a sort of plain vanilla commoditization of news. That there is a way of doing a news story which is this. And if we're first with it, then that's what we're doing competitively to get competitive edge. And I think that's very weak. I think that what it leads to, in my particular field, in my particular specialist field, is the desire simply to find ways of quoting the Archbishop of Canterbury in a selective way in order to make the front page of the newspaper. Yeah. And that, never mind, you know, the subject matter specifically, but that happens in so many areas that it's really rather depressing. And it does mean, to Cole's point, that proper, good, old-fashioned stories are right under journalists' noses, but they daren't go for them with the disciplines of the old days, if you like, because the competition are taking the route that I've just described. And to be left out of that lemming-like rush is to put your job in jeopardy, so you go for the easy stuff.
It's interesting, your point about the Olympics, isn't it? Because Who would buy the paper if the first 15 pages were a dissection of the Chinese regime and the medal report was on page 16, especially if Britain's doing well?
Well, my earlier point was that they would, you see, because they do. When we do that, they buy the paper, but what they read is the medal report.
Right. Yeah.
But you know, that's a slightly different issue to flooding the place with journalists. I mean, because the line of argument we were going down was that somehow we're not pursuing the truth because we haven't got the resources. But there you are, the greatest festival of journalism this year in Beijing, and nobody's asking the right questions.
Yeah, I can just point out a lot of those people have gone to cover the sport.
Well, why? But that's the point. Because we decide that the sport is the most important thing.
Why
is it? Yeah, but why? I mean, that wasn't true. That wasn't true. Even in the mid 70s, in the 80s, it wasn't true that the sport was the most important thing about the Olympics. It's a cultural event. It's an international event. The canoeing is not as important as what's going on in China in relation to the rest of us.
Or I could say, in the example of the United States, there are going to be, I think, something like 1,700 journalists at the Democratic Convention on Monday. right? Which is a completely canned event
that
will have no news whatsoever.
Yeah, yeah.
And they'll be chasing each other around to quote one another, but they all feel as if they have to be there.
I'm just going to ask one more question of the panel, and then I'd like to throw it open to you guys. Your point about Rowan Williams, because what I find increasingly now is that newspapers can't tell complicated stories well. They don't really understand complicated people, and everything is reduced all the time to things that they think their audience will understand. So they're also making their audience less able to understand complicated stories.
That's disingenuous, if I may say so slightly. Newspapers can't do it. Radio 5 certainly can't do it. When the issues happened around Christmas, around the Archbishop of Canterbury and Nick Clegg saying he didn't believe in God, that wasn't a complicated story. That was reported in a very direct, very simple way about Nick Clegg saying he didn't believe in God because he was put on the spot, and the Archbishop of Canterbury giving a response to it. But what actually happened was that Simon interviewed the Archbishop of Canterbury at length, fascinating, in-depth interview that was subsequently reported like that. So it's not just us that can't do it, it's every medium that can't do it.
Well, I think that's right, but to Rianne's point, I sort of endorse what he's saying. to take the most recent post-Lambeth conference story, when Dr. Deborah Pitt leaked 8-year-old letters, which revealed, in quotation marks, the Archbishop of Canterbury's personal views with regard to sexual ethics, at the time as he wrote them 8 years ago, the papers went bonkers precisely on the principle that I was referring to earlier. And our own newspaper included, and I'm critical internally about this, on the basis that the danger of missing the story, as it were, of not doing what the Times were going to do with that story, outweighed looking at what the story really consisted of. And I think that there was a reporting job to be done in exploring whether this was much of a revelation or not, and what the background of publicly quoted comments of the Archbishop of Canterbury were. And it took me 20 minutes. And it took me 20 minutes largely because I'm not very good with the internet. But it would have taken my son 7 minutes to have found half a dozen references, all of which were in those letters, from 1989 onwards by the Archbishop of Canterbury saying very similar things. Now, I'd like to suggest that 15 or 20 years ago, that sort of view in an editorial conference would have been, oh, well, not much of a story then. You could run the leaking of it as a nib on page 17. But that process no longer occurs, and that is to do with people not allowing themselves or allowing their news teams or allowing their staff and their journalistic resources to be sufficiently complicated. And that's really not very complicated at all. In fact, it's not about complication, it's about being too simplistic.
I was thinking about Sharia law as well, but I won't go into that. So your questions, please, and you can ask whatever you like, and if the panel can't answer it, maybe somebody here from a different part of the press, media, can do so. Now, I'm going to start... No, you're not reading my notes, mate. journalist.
Could you please be patient with me? There is only one of me and only one mic.
I'm going to do it like that to save Ben's feet. We'll start here and then we'll work round in a clockwise direction.
You've done this before.
Keep things brief. Please get round.
Okay.
And if you've got a person you'd most like to answer that, perhaps you could say that at the beginning of your question.
Probably to Cole.
Very,
very interesting debate. I'm a reporter. I've seen my own experience. We don't get out and report as much as we should.
Who do you report for?
I'm at the Church Times now. I find it really tedious, the fact that especially church stories just get reduced to very black and white. The whole gay issue is so tedious, and if you're anti-gay, you're a right-wing fundamentalist. And anyway, sorry, I'm rambling. But to Cole, The Independent on Sunday did a story: Christian MPs employ Christian interns. You don't say. It's your front page. How did you let that one go? Because that was just the non-story of the month.
Yeah. decade. Your check's in the post.
But wait till you get to my plan. Yeah, it was rubbish. What can I say? If you want a practical, truthful answer, I wasn't there.
What would you have done if you had been there?
Argued like hell.
I was on holiday.
Well, I was. I mean, that is the truth. I was, and it was rubbish.
You
can go back and quote that to anybody you like. That front page was rubbish.
If you'd been the editor, would you have said?
I said it's not a story.
Yeah, I mean, if I had been there that week, and I would have been as loud as I possibly could in saying we should dump this. And, you know, that has happened. And, you know, I mean, this is kind of a bit too personal, a bit too domestic, but those kind of discussions happen all the time. It's what it's symptomatic of, though, is a bigger thing. And, you know, we could talk more generally about the way that our kinds of newspapers, I'm including George in this, report the church. Because somewhere along the line, it has been decided, A, that the church is the Church of England, and B, that the church is dead. Well, the Church of England may or may not be dead. But I don't think that goes for the church. Now, you know, you could say that newspapers don't understand that and should report that. Let me tell you, I don't think that 95% of Christians understand that. So, you know, we're in an imperfect world, and you've nailed me.
Well, no, to throw Cole a line here, it's precisely to the point that I was making earlier, that we ran, as the Telegraph, we ran that story about the leaked letters by Deborah Pitt in Wales to the then Archbishop of Wales, now Archbishop of Canterbury. And we ran it like sort of everybody else did, and I think it led the BBC website for a while and all that sort of thing. And your example was, you know, Christian interns employed by a Christian organisation, you don't say, you know, knock me down with a medallion, you know. Well, you know, let's apply that to that particular story that we ran big. Rowan Williams believes theologically that same-sex unions can reflect the love of God. You don't say, you know. I mean,
yeah.
But it's to this idea that there's some kind of okay journalistic response to anything that a piece of journalism says is amazing, without any objective analysis as to whether it's amazing or not.
Can I just say one thing to that as well, though? This is personal, okay? For me, Greenbelt is a safe space, and I've just realised that for me to say in a public meeting that front page is rubbish will get me in a lot of trouble. So I would ask you to respect the fact that for me Greenbelt is a safe space, and I'm just being totally truthful with you. If you're in here and you're thinking, great for Media Guardian, please don't.
However, I think the Telegraph believes that the public has a right to know.
In that case, we can run a story in our media column about you calling me a wanker.
Oh, nice.
And you're all live on Five Live anyway, too. I'm just going to say something about Five Live here, because it's a good moment for me to do it. Simon Mayo is a very good thing for Five Live.
Oh, he's fabulous.
Because when we were having, the media was, you know, I don't like women bishops, I do, I just black and white that.
Yeah, yeah.
Simon just said, I want a bishop on who's just an ordinary bishop in the middle, listening to one side, listening to the other, and I'm going to talk to him for half an hour.
Yeah.
And that was a really enlightening piece of radio journalism.
And I want to say too that, and you know, this is a love-in, right? Going to be tough, live with it. The interviews that he's doing, and that Archbishop one was one of them, are one of the few spaces where he is actually giving space and listening to people and seeing what they say and responding to them. And the guy in terms of interviewing is gold dust.
Yeah, well, you'll get a different service at breakfast because it's fast and it's rapid. But yeah, Simon, you get some time. Anyway, that plug for Five Live over. It's shameless, isn't it? Lady in the red jacket.
Thank you very much. Hi there, thanks very much. I'd be interested to know what the panel feel about the coverage in the UK media of the situation in Israel and Palestine. Do you feel it does it well? Do you feel it's fair? Do you feel it's accurate? And I'd be interested to know what influence the UK Jewish media has, the UK Jewish lobby has on the coverage in the media on these issues. Thanks.
I don't feel qualified to answer that question. I'm sorry, that sounds like a cop-out. It probably is, but I don't feel qualified to answer it. George, mate?
Well...
Tick, tick, tick.
I think it's important to dispense at every opportunity with the idea that there is a global Jewish conspiracy in the media to support Israel's position in the Middle East. I think that's neither true in general, nor true of the many Jewish colleagues and friends that I have in the media who are not only offended but aghast at the allegation.
Sorry, I misspoke. I didn't mean Jewish people in the media.
No, I didn't describe. I wasn't suggesting that you were. I wasn't suggesting you were for a moment. No, I just sort of saying that that's an aspect of what we need to deal with in the media with regard to Middle East politics and diplomacies and so on. The second thing that I think I've come across there is the assumption very often, and that's one of them, that there is this kind of international media conspiracy pro-Israel, that is much more than anything that's about the Anglican Communion or whether we write so about much. Religion, and that's bad enough, frankly, because if you get put into camps as soon as you write a single sentence on religion, which may not be a camp that you're happy to be put into. But anyway, that sort of categorization is so insane in any case. So one of the really irritating and stupid and babyish aspects of the media is that anything that I write that's critical about the state of Israel will get 100 followed by 1,000 online comments calling me anti-Semitic. I think somebody did a scientific research test on this, and that, you know, anyone in my position who writes anything about Palestine-Israel politics will have, on average, the word Hitler mentioned within 7 postings online, and, you know, very often sooner than that. And, you know, that's a childish categorisation. And the last thing I think I want to say on that is that I have found it easier, frankly, in the pulpit as a priest to say that something like Israel's action in South Lebanon is an abomination of biblical proportions than I'm ever allowed to say in the newspaper for reasons that I've just alluded to.
Who's next in our clockwise journey round the tent?
I think if I wanted to find out what was going on at the end of a year, probably the FT would be the paper to have, because they have to get the facts right, because people are making big money decisions on the basis of it. But you'd be bored witless, wouldn't you? What I would want from the media, which I don't think I get at all, is that they would make it reasonably easy to find out what's going on. You can find out eventually what's going on if you read enough and if you research enough, but it's flaming hard work and most of us haven't got the time to do it.
Do you read the FT every day then?
No.
Why not?
Because I'd be bored witless. And you also, you'd need to learn how to read, you know, how to read between the lines of the stories to work out what's going on. But I mean, the people who are making big money decisions want to know exactly what's happening, because they want to have their money in the right place, don't they?
Well,
and I think that paper is serving those interests.
Do you know, I actually think that's not a terrible thing to ask of readers, which is that they learn to read between the lines, whether it's Financial Times or any paper. I mean, that really is your job, to read between the lines, whatever paper you're reading. But it's not simply a technical problem.
I mean, let's be clear, you know, with the layers and levels of media, from mainstream to independent to personal to blogging, globally, available via the internet, you have got no excuse. If you want to know what is really going on in a situation, you've got no excuse. It's there. It's easier than it's ever been in history to get myriad perspectives on a single event.
But it's harder as well, isn't it? Because you're looking for a trusted guide. Who do you trust to guide you through that morass of information? Who is going to take you where you...
Well, that brings us back to...
Where's the honest broker?
Well, that brings us back to the notion of truth, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And you're saying, who guides us to the truth? I think George and I would agree, there isn't one. What there is a myriad perspectives. It's up to you what you do with those perspectives. But if you're looking for one person to tell you this is the truth about what's happening, I think you're in the wrong game. I don't think that's there.
The most valuable thing... sorry, this sounds a bit earnest and sanctimonious, but the most valuable thing journalistically when I was a redneck reporter that an editor said to me was, when I was arguing the case for a story that I'd pulled in, was, George, there's your truth, there's my truth, and there's the truth, you know. Meaning that it's a movable feast, and depending on where you stand, the truth is a different thing.
So out with someone.
This is a question for each one of you, and it also was a bit simplistic, so bear with me. Could I ask each one of you, which one thing would you change at your media outlet to make it a better place to be a reporter?
What, the one we work in?
Yeah.
Oh, I see. I'm astonished at how little... I probably referred to this earlier. I'm astonished how little news reporters get out anymore and meet people and talk to them and find out what's going on. One of the tyrannies of technology and information technology is that everything is apparently, allegedly, delivered to the desk. And that's to do with the way the economics of newspapers are run, and it's to do with that tyranny of technology. So if I could introduce some kind of injunction from Brussels that news reporters had to spend at least 60% of their time outside their place of work, then that would be a change that I would wholeheartedly support.
Well, I have the privilege of having a job that mainly involves going out and talking to people and finding out what they think's going on. But that's nice for me, eh? what I would do... Well, there are a number of things I could say in relation to independent newspapers. I'm going to be more careful than I was just now and say, obviously, they should pay the journalists more and they should give us all chauffeurs. And I do think that our particular newspapers are 5 years behind the times when it comes to the internet, and we ought to get our act together on that. But really, in the end, what would make it most improvement would be if the word got out that this was something worth buying, and that's, you know, that would help.
Right.
Do you want to...
Well, I don't have an outlet now, so I could wish for anything. But I actually do agree with the idea that reporters should be out reporting rather than talking to other reporters or talking to PR hacks. And I think the other thing that I would devoutly wish for is that journalists would stop getting shot at.
Yeah, absolutely. I want to pick that up, actually. I had an extraordinary privilege today to meet two journalists from Africa, Jade and Stephanie, who are here with the Right to Life programme for torture victims. Extraordinary women with amazing stories. You know, Jade sort of calmly said, oh, yeah, my husband was beheaded, you know, and she didn't want to talk about it. Surprise, surprise. But those are two women who had to leave their countries because of the things they were writing, right? So, you know, it's not about Big Brother in the end, is it?
Can I add something? I'm chairing, I shouldn't really add something, but at the BBC, I would like there to be... It would be easier for people from different backgrounds to become reporters, because I think there are too many people who are too similar, chasing, therefore, similar stories. And if we could get a wider range of people from different classes and backgrounds, we would have... more stories worth reading.
Can I just add that I don't know if you're a journalist or a reporter. Are you? Sort of?
Ex-journalist.
Well, go back into it, because You prefaced it by saying it's a simplistic question. You might have been
working for Closer.
Yeah.
Reveal.
Yeah.
Really glad to
it's so.
It's
so
even all the more reason to go back into.
So
it.
Not a simplistic question. I don't. The other thing I would add is that simplistic questions journalistically are invariably the best ones.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. It's the person at the back of the room that goes, "Excuse me, but why is your company doing this?" Yeah. Not kind of what's the tax charge.
Yeah. Why? That's the best question of all.
Next question.
Just like to thank panelists for their talk. I'm a trainee civil servant, so I'm probably not going to be very fond of journalists when I grow up. But you mentioned it briefly, touched on it in points. What are the positive and negative aspects of the internet? How has it changed journalism for you?
Well, what everyone says is there's too much, and there's too much of the same thing. But I think in the work that I've done, what I actually see as incredibly positive is the ability of journalists who are not in the first world to be able to tell their stories in a way that gets heard. So that I was working a couple of years ago for the U.S. television show Frontline, and we were able to actually have all over the world kids with cheap digital cameras doing work and actually have access to that in a way that just wasn't possible before, when the model was you send the American or the Brit out to report on the natives. And at this point, you actually don't have that. You have much more of a multiplicity of perspectives. Doesn't mean that everybody still wants to read that. They often want to have the trusted white person reporting on the natives, right? But that's there, and that's accessible. And I think that's really changed the way that I look at international news.
Yeah, I think that there are lots of profound things to say about the egalitarian nature of the internet and the revolutionary aspect of it, and the fact that it gives people a voice, and the fact that movements now happen in an afternoon where they used to happen in 6 months or a year. You know, it used to be said that you could fill Trafalgar Square in 6 months if you lobbied a movement. That was said, you know, as recently as the turn of the century. You know, now you could fill Trafalgar Square overnight if you... You know, if you use the internet, if not before that. But on a completely different level, positives and negatives. The positives are that Wikipedia makes you an instant expert on everything, and the negative aspect is it also makes you a complete arse from time to time.
You read my entry.
What's he kidding? You paid me 10 quid to write it.
I endorse what Sarah and Cole said about positives and so on. Could I just add one brief sort of rather old-fashioned view with regard to the internet? I do think that the whole onlineness with regard to journalism has removed or undermined time to think. Very often our reporters and I as a commentator and other commentators are required, because it exists, to slap something up quickly. And I think that that can have qualitative considerations which weren't the same. I'm not suggesting we go back, or I'm not trying to be retrogressive here, but when it was only ever going to appear in first edition, printed, going to the Stone at 7 o'clock tonight, if I was talking about this at 3 o'clock, I had until 7 o'clock before I actually committed myself to keyboard. Very often I'm committing myself to keyboard instantly, and I'm not sure that that is always terribly healthy. Although, the benefits probably outweigh that. I just think we've got to be careful of that. And the other thing I would say, since we're online, and I'm sure it's ready internet, but when it comes to online comments about, there is a great democracy that's been created in terms of, in the old days, journalists wrote rude things and readers wrote letters. Now we write and readers are rude, which in a sense, I suppose, is a healthy development. But actually what there is that there's a constituency of regular, very rude people. But they drive everybody else off the comment threads. I'm convinced it's a false democracy. And I think that's something we need to be careful about as well.
We've got anti-clockwise.
You
should have sought permission for that, you see.
Oh, sorry about this. I was waving a hand at him and...
He has had his hand on the long
You're welcome. Of course you are. I'm making cheap...
Well, now, I was a national news reporter until 40 years ago when I became an Anglican clergyman. I find it a bit depressing to hear that the profession has deteriorated in its morals even more than it was when I worked in it. I recognise one virtue that we had that you don't have now, which is that we did believe in getting out, talking to the people and getting the news that way. And such dealings as I ever have with reporters nowadays, that seems to be a very rare thing indeed. The biggest corruption that I personally experienced was in the field of industrial relations. In my time, if there was a strike and you worked for a right-wing newspaper, you went out and you wrote a story about the Reds under the bed who were causing it. You did not write a story about the basic discontents that were being expressed. And in fact, industrial disputes did arise from deeply seated social malaise. And we live in the society which has refused and still refuses to recognise that that malaise is there. As for Archbishops of Canterbury, well, I reported a number of speeches by Archbishops of Canterbury, and the form was that there were rather more specialised ecclesiastical reporters around in those days. What you did was you got together as a group and you considered the speech and you all decided together what was the news angle in it, so that you didn't have a different angle from anybody else because you were in trouble if you did. I would suspect that that's the kind of thing which still goes on. Thanks a lot.
Thank you. One of the two gentlemen in burgundy here, I think. Burgundy with white stripe.
Thank you. Can I go back to the sorry. Is this not burgundy?
That's burgundy with a white stripe. We'll come to burgundy.
If I go back to the Olympics, I'm just a wee bit concerned or confused about the balance and numbers of reporters and people that are out there. You mentioned 437 BBC people. I'd actually read there was 450. Maybe that's journalistic license, just rounding it up. But I think there's 313 competitors across the board in the GB Olympic team. And a lot of people, a lot of athletes can't go because of lack of funding. And I know it's too simplistic to say, well, you know, if a journalist doesn't go, another athlete can go. But I just, you know, it seems to me that I listen to Five Live an awful lot, and I'm not really sure that Peter Allen needs to be there and Nicky Campbell needs to be there. And, you know, the BBC, on the television, sorry, do they really need Michael Johnson and Colin Jackson? You know, I just think the numbers are a bit skewed, and frankly, there's probably a lot of BBC people out there on a jolly.
I think I should say something.
Please do.
That's yours.
Okay, I didn't make any of those decisions. So, you know, I genuinely didn't make them, but, you know, Five Lives and News and Sports Station, it's not only, we've got two stations, we've got Sports Extra and Five Live. So it'd be a bit weird if we didn't cover the Olympics, and I think our listeners would be quite surprised and appalled.
But to pick up on the point,
but that I'm just going to finish. Just also, I really don't think I can answer for deployment of all the journalists because I can only really talk about Five Live. But I just will make one point: is that we're providing an awful lot of coverage, television, online, radio. I know it doesn't really answer the question, and I'm really sorry, but Five Live, I'll answer for. Did you want to say something?
I was just going to say that I thought that the point, and he could speak for himself, because I agree with him, unusually. Cole was making the point that, you know, that in his view, and I think we have to stress that it's in his view, as it would be in, you know, because the views on these vary on what a story is, to the point of, you know, with regard to that point of where truth lies that we were making earlier. But I found it disconcerting or unsettling, frankly, that so much sports journalism was committed to it, and so little political, diplomatic, or foreign, in the broadest sense, journalism was committed to it. I know, in a sense, why to your point, were so many sports journalists sent out and not Nick Cohen, John Pilger, Gavin Hewitt?
Yeah, I'll just come back to it briefly and say this, that I have loved the coverage, and it's been extraordinarily good, hasn't it? You know, on all the, across all those platforms, and detailed, wonderful sports coverage. My point was not really about that, because I think that in terms of the spectacle of the Olympics, that level of coverage is probably justified. It is that... you know, we were talking about lack of resources holding us back in terms of looking for the truth, and I think it's an example where loads and loads of resources have been thrown at something, and the truth or something like it has been slightly missed.
You could have spared some of the buckets, couldn't you?
Yeah, but more generally on sport, just to try and get it away from that. You know, it is true. For example, an England football match happens. It's reported. Say it happens on a Wednesday, it's reported by a reporter who reports the match, it's reported by a commentator who describes whatever he feels about the way the players played, it's reported in terms of the TV coverage, and then 4 days later it's repeated all over again in a Sunday paper where they pick it apart again, and a grand old man comes in and talks about 1954 and Billy this and, you know, and when they used to play in long shorts and all of that, and there is a kind of pomposity and self-importance and overindulgence about sports reporting that, you know, has to stop, frankly, just in terms of resources.
A bit like the land of the conference.
Hi, that's quite appropriate, actually, because I was going to ask the panel's opinion about national news coverage on Christians and Christianity and to what extent they think it's balanced and fair.
Go on, George. You're most accountable.
I've made the point earlier that journalists increasingly live in fear about what somebody else is writing, and quite senior journalists as well. So the story is defined very often by what the kind of herd instinct is. So I won't repeat that point, but I think it's quite germane to this in terms of deciding that disputes over sexuality are the most important communion-splitting issue that is facing Christians everywhere, which clearly isn't true when you speak to them or us. So, you know, there is that, but I won't bang that drum again because I think that point has been made. I think in terms of broader coverage, I think that we're not good as media at being religious affairs correspondents, or in my case, whatever, it doesn't matter what the title is, but, you know, religion stuff. Because there's a clue in the title, you know, religion, you know. And I remember when I turned up at the paper, I better not name who it is because I'm more careful than Cole and I don't know you so well. But I got what I thought was quite a nice little tale. It would lead the front. It may not even be a page lead. But it was worth checking out, following it up. And on a thin day, it would make something that was quite good, which was about how the Reform Synagogue, in terms of Reform Judaism, which isn't, after all, as left-wing, as I understand it, as liberal Judaism, was issuing the first new liturgy for 30 years that was gender-inclusive. You know, that's worth following up. Now, the correspondent I was speaking to momentarily looked a bit blankly at me, and I thought that blankness was to do with, George, why would we be covering this? And to a lady who was talking about our coverage of Middle East politics earlier, I don't for a moment suggest that my colleague was anti-Jewish, far less anti-Semitic. But he seemed to have the mentality, which was the old-style churches correspondent, as the Bishop of London, as he now is, used to be called when he worked for the Daily Telegraph. You know, what we write about is the Church of England. Well, I'm talking about the Telegraph now to some degree. The Guardian has a Muslim religious affairs correspondent, Alleluia, in Riaz Akbar. But very often we're far too narrowly focused on Christianity when we're religious affairs correspondents. And I think it would do us all a lot of good if we honoured our commitment to being religious affairs correspondents.
My comment from the United States is very different. I think it's a very different landscape in which, huge religion stories go just terribly reported and underreported. The rise of the religious right is just terribly reported and caricatured. I also think you have a situation in the United States where people in newsrooms are disproportionately not Christians, not believers of any kind. As an editor of mine said to me once, I didn't know any smart people believed in God, right? Yeah. So there's this entire sort of modernist assumption that journalism is a science and religion is not a science and you can't prove it. Therefore, we write about it in the crudest folkloric ways so that we use religion as a stand-in for class when we're writing about the United States right wing, or we use religion as a stand-in for ethnicity when we're writing about the Muslim world. But we actually don't look at what people think and what they believe and what that has to do with the way that they act politically in the world. And I think it's because newsrooms are so secular or so afraid of being religious at all. And that's really a change from sort of post-war period where you still had basically white ethnic Catholics in the newsroom, and now you don't as much.
I could say things that would open up a whole different area of debate around this, and I'm writing a book about it, so I'll keep until next year when you can buy the book and talk to me then. But I would say this, that the complaint is that the church is not taken seriously in the press and, say, in government and in the establishment in general. My take on that is the church has lost the right to be taken seriously.
Thank you. Panel, can we take several questions at once, rather, because I think we aren't going to get round all the lovely people that have caught my eye and waved their hands at me. So
Okay. We'll
take several questions at once.
We're due to finish
then,
at 8:30, I think, aren't we? So we've got 10
yes,
more minutes,
10 minutes.
Of fun to go. If we've got anything really controversial to say, that'd be great, wouldn't it? Bring it on.
A number of issues that the panel's covered have touched on commercial pressures, either directly in terms of pandering to readers or indirectly in terms of resources and stuff like that. And I was just wondering, if by some monster endowment or whatever mechanism you choose to think about, your organisation didn't have to worry about profit or about justifying a licence fee, what would be different?
Can I have a go at that?
Some really boring.
Hold on, we're going to get some more.
I'm chairing, allegedly, yeah. But it's all got a bit muddy.
I'll make Jonathan Dimbleby.
I'm just relaxed.
There goes BBC objectivity out the window.
Isn't it? You know... Okay. Sorry, I was going to answer that, but I can't because Ben wants to take part.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
The question I'm going to ask is more to do with another influence on the media we get that's not been brought up today, which is spin doctors. PR, huge industry, media management, everybody's got to have it. Blair government got criticised for spin, but was very successful. Brown government is criticised for having poor media management, and is not so successful. So does Gordon Brown need a new Alistair Campbell to get a decent press?
Hold those thoughts.
Do you think the media picks on soft targets?
I think that's enough, Ben, or we'll explode.
One more. One more.
All right, on your head be it. You get answers to the wrong things.
If there's a shrapnel, I'll deal with it.
You jokingly mentioned Reveal and Closer and Heat at the start, but I think that actually across the media, include broadsheets, we're including lots of celeb stories, and I think we're getting the press we deserve. We're buying celeb stuff, and everyone's putting it more of it in because that's what sells. Just want to know if you agree.
Okay. George is going to talk about spin doctors.
Oh.
I'm going to talk about what I do with some money. We'll all talk about celebrities. And who we missed out?
Soft target.
Soft target.
Well, I can, yeah.
Okay, we'll all do that. Is that all right? If I had loads of money, I'd have loads more reporters. And I'd put them all over Britain. And I'd give them time to go and find some stories and research them properly. And the other thing I do was, we have quite a good relationship with the audience on Five Live. They send us loads and loads of stories, and we don't have the resources to research all of them all the time. And I'd love to do that, because that's a great conversation, the one that we have with our audience, and to be able to do more with them and get them more involved in the whole process of journalism. Not in a kind of, we do user-generated content, oh great, you know, which I think is sometimes lip service, not necessarily across the media, actually. So I'd invest more money in reporting. That's what I would do. I mean, it's not. Anybody else want to invest money?
Invest money. I just wanted, it just reminded me of the story years ago when an elderly gentleman phoned on Saturday night when I was on The Observer and said, could you tell me what's in the newspaper tomorrow? And my colleague sitting next to me on the desk said, well, spend 50p or whatever it was in those days and you'll find out, won't you? Fuck off. the editor's phone then rang, and it was the same quavery voice said, hello, Donald, is it? He said, yeah, it's a familiar voice. He said, hello, it's Tiny. Tiny Roland, who owned The Observer in those days. And he said, I just found you on the news desk, and they told me that if I wanted to find out what's in the paper tomorrow, I should spend 50 pence on, and fuck off. And Donald, to his shame, said, I'm so sorry, sir, I'll find him and have him flogged, or something to that effect. So I went, no, he's looking after my commercial interests. Which I thought was revealing. I don't know why. It's not much of an answer to your question, but it's getting late. Spin doctors. I'm a former spin doctor. I took a commercial break for 15 years. Hell, you know. You could say at some time in their life they haven't made a 15-year career mistake. But anyway. I'm dubious about this idea that there are these black art spin doctors who manipulate newspapers and all that sort of thing. You know, I'm the first to criticise Alistair for what he did and the way in which he behaved, the way in which he ran government communication. But I have to say that a lot of me says that he was giving, for the first time, as good as he used to get from journalists. You know, it's kind of, we could be robuster about each other. The idea that I, as a spin doctor, could have manipulated Cole, you know, and got him to write what I wanted. I have to tell you, I wouldn't be here now. I'd be sunning myself on some Caribbean island that I bought myself. You know. So actually, I think it's quite healthy that there are commercial advocates. There are journalists who buy their arguments, don't buy their arguments, buy a bit of their arguments, or whatever. I think that's a healthy engagement. Soft targets. I think journalists are much more self-regarding, vain, and pompous than that. They'd much rather be taking on hard targets. I'm well armed. Me, I take on the Chancellor of the Exchequer or the Cray brothers, or you know, or the Independent, or something. Anyway, I've run over the road. Go on.
That's all right. That's a good answer, wasn't it? I think I'm happy to leave it there.
Can I tell a story about Gordon Brown's new spin doctor?
Who is it?
Not me, is it?
I'm not going to name names, but she's not very good, and he really does need some better people.
Not Sarah Brown, is it?
No, I'm not saying any more, otherwise I'll get into trouble.
You know what? People forget about that, though, don't they? You know, this whole business about poor old Gordon was the heart and soul of the Labour Party, and he was going to come out, turn his shadow, and rescue us all. That was spin in the first place. And also, you know, who was the man who paid for the bombs that bombed the children in Iraq? The Chancellor. He was complicit in everything from 1997 onwards. So I think the idea that he can now be rescued and we can return to the idea that he's a wonderful chap is a bit skew-whiff.
Yeah.
Well, that's not taking...